And welcome to the Dice and Screaming Podcast. Yeah, I like that one. Hey, I'm Randy.
I'm Mike.
And together we are the Dice and Screaming Podcast. Hey, welcome, folks. It's our post-geek Thanksgiving show. I want to say that right.
Yes.
And I hope you all had a good one. If you didn't, and, you know, in a country that doesn't have it, well, we hope you had a good week, and thanks for joining us. Either way, we're a day late, dollar short as usual, but we're here with the podcast.
Yeah. First,
today we're going to be talking about the Monsters Arms Race, which kind of coincides with the 80s Cold War, but we're really going to talk about what the General Proliferation Treaty was signed for.
Before
Strategic Monster Limitation Treaty.
Before the salt talks.
Yeah.
Followed by the pepper talks. Followed by the eating of the monsters which were killed. And were then covered in salt and pepper.
Some are magically delicious.
Just the leprechauns. Wow. Oh, strawberry snickles. I see demons.
Yeah, usually a lot of
Sorry.
There's no there's no pot of gold at the end of this rainbow.
And you can expect no less than this. From the dramatic pause of gaming podcasts.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
All right. Much. Well, you know, he's here all week, folks.
That's yeah.
Hannah, he's back.
That's what they don't pay me for. And wisely so. Nor should, like, they honestly, you know, they shouldn't even be allowed to throw peanuts to me like they occasionally do, because that just encourages my misbehavior.
Yeah, and I have some humble pie to eat along with my Thanksgiving dessert. Yeah, it was pointed out that they did, for the Pathfinder remaster, I actually got my to sit down and read. Of course, I don't read the spells. Here's a confession, okay? When I get a new game, the last thing I read is spells. Because to me, as a game master, and primarily even as a player, the first thing I want to know is how this whole thing works. So I want to tear right into the guts of it, get on with it, and kind of just get right into it, okay? So the spells are kind of peripheral
okay.
to the rules. They're kind of conditional. You know, if you got a magic, obviously you're going to have somebody casting spells, but I didn't really pay that close attention to it. I was like, yeah, okay, I took somebody's word for it on Reddit that they were renaming the Fireball and Lightning Bolt, which... Hey, you know what? Misinformation happens on the interweb, and shame on me for not doing my due diligence. I feel anybody who is like misled on that, I need to take a step back on that. But a lot of the other stuff I seen on the remaster, it was, if you were expecting a whole bunch of stuff, as we said, to change, you're going to be very disappointed. There's just not a whole lot there to change. And we
the more hysterical complaints were in a lot of cases made by people who have never purchased the material and have no intention of purchasing the material, but are just there to like troll for rage clicks. You know, you cannot trust everything you see. In fairness, though, some of the changes they're making, like we did say, I mean, the one thing I know we did get right is that the root cause of this is legally bulletproofing themselves against any future action that might compromise them or, you know, place them in an actionable position in terms of intellectual property contests. So, you know, I don't think any of us were looking forward to some of these changes, but at least at this show, we know why they're doing it, and we kind of accept that at, like, face value right there. Okay, yeah, I see why you have to do this, because... I'm not saying that old Yeller has rabies yet, but, you know, WOTC has been kind of wandering around in the sun with no real purpose and growling at random. And, you know, like, I haven't seen foam yet. Like, we don't have to shoot it and put it down yet. But there are some warning signs there that everybody should be concerned about. So taking some precautions like, okay, we're not going to let it play with the baby in the yard.
Well, more importantly...
It is what it is, folks.
Yeah, you're going to have... Yeah, our owlbear is gone. Are they going to leave pretty much draw laying on the cutting room floor? Sure. But if you have older stuff or Archives of Nethys, you can use an owlbear in your game. And heck, if you're really that bent out of shape to use some of the D&D monster, classic D&D monsters experience and ignore some of the new stuff, hey, go right for it. I'm personally looking forward to something new in the direction of the dragons, which the bestiary isn't out yet. But I want to see that one.
Want to watch how they respin that, because conceptually the dragon is an essential part of fantasy and it is not something that any one group can own. However, the chromatic metallic concepts as like two oppositional factions of dragonkind is uniquely and specifically Dungeons and Dragons oriented. So now, while D&D cannot own a color or like an appearance per se, but the title of the precise wording will have to be very tricky. Seeing how they work their way around this, I gotta say I'm looking forward to it, because I believe it can be done pretty easily. There's a huge variety of ways to look at it, whether you go to an elemental based system or...
Well, they're using the four schools of magic, or the four forms of magic in the Pathfinder universe, which are primal, druidic, divine, and of course, arcane. You know, can't miss that one, and occult. So the dragons are going to be aligned on those four axes.
Cool. Occult dragon. I feel like I just formed a new metal band.
Mm-hmm. Cold dragon. Stoner metal.
So
got you some bad game.
Yeah.
All right. So, we beat this subject to this. We'll be keeping up with Pathfinder 2E here. We also want to give a passing mention to the fine folks who did Duck Pack. Hey, they're gold sellers at DriveThruRPG.
Oh, and speaking of which, like this Thanksgiving, those of you who are fans of ducks, I totally made duck a l'orange.
Oh, man.
Which, I'm just throwing it out there. If I ever play a duck in RuneQuest, I will name him L'Orange.
Sure. It's that warning and dire circumstance in our future.
And
why wouldn't we
be? And he will be delicious.
Yeah, I bet. So, yeah, all of 10 minutes that he lasts. So, you know, there's that. We will take that for people who want to put the... ducks into the limelight. Kind of like with Troll Pack, Duck Pack is out. You can get it on print demand. So go look it up if you're interested in RuneQuest and you want to know what the heck is up with ducks. How do I integrate them with my campaign?
Come to the duck side. We have cookies.
Yeah. And quackers.
Yeah. It's quacked up to
be. Yes, it is.
Just put that one on my bill.
Oh, I know the joke for that one, so I'm just going to stop right there. All right, so moving right along. As Kermit the Frog said. Moving right along. Next up we have, next up we have for our act is What Lays in Store. And for that, for the future, it's always in motion. So the only way to divine the future is through the use of the Astrogalomancer. And here he is, ready to roll the dice and tell us what lays in store for us.
The Astrogalomancer gazes into the future. All right. It's a hot night in Vegas. Mm. Now, he sees a meta discussion on classes themselves, like backing up from the individual classes, which we have spoken of in the past, like having a look at the nature and the breakdown of what they are and what they do, and why we love them, because we love them all. Mm-hmm. But this is a meta discussion on classes themselves. Now, why are some beloved and why are some sometimes falling by the wayside? What is it that draws people to very specific roles and very specific character types, and what sends them careening the other direction, going, oh no, not even with my other NPCs used 10-foot pole.
Oh, wow.
Which is, man, that's saying something. But there are some who enjoy some of the less popular classes, But meta-knowledge is now available to us thanks to the internet and to RPG Baldur's games Gate. And Baldur's Gate 3.
Yeah.
We're able to look at actual real-time examples of how many people pick what type of class. And it gives us a window into what makes one class more exciting than another or more seen as more desirable to play than another. So we're going to do a meta examination on classes as a concept.
Yeah, and we're going to, some classes are going to get more love than others. Obviously some like subclass would be looked at in the old, older editions of subclasses. Yeah, we're going to lump them in with their main class, but we're also going to be taking a look at what the archetypes are, what is how they've changed over the years, and as we were weighing this discussion, you know, there's a difference between, like, when you say I play a bard, well, everybody just assumes that you play the horny bard now that is popular, the popular trope, but we come from an era when you say you play a bard, people are like, well, sir,
I salute you.
All right, well, you know,
you basically, like, to, you know, use the word bard, you lived through 11 to 13 levels of other stuff before you even got to show up and use that word. That's a fighting rogue.
I just want to shake your hand, mister.
You paid that many levels worth of dues as a fighter and a rogue just to get here.
Just to play a lute. And cast druid spells. So here we are.
Yeah, that, like, if you want to kick back with a guitar on the porch with your gray beard after, like, you know, 200,000 XP's worth of adventures, you are entitled and nobody's going to stand between you and that. Like, you picked that guitar on the porch, buddy. You earned it.
So, yeah.
You but, get so it means something different to us.
You're right.
Than it means to...
maybe some people have just come into the game lately. And that's a topic that we're going to explore.
We admit that perhaps Scanlan from... Critical Role has not helped the reputation of the bard.
Sure.
But we love him anyway.
Look, you love people for who they are, and he is honestly who he is. There is no pretense about that.
Yeah, I mean, he's not. It's not like he's concealing anything. Frequently, not concealing anywhere near enough. In fact, they're frequently begging, "Could you please conceal that?"
It's just, it's like a comedy.
I'm sorry, but Scanlan and I have a lot in common.
All right.
You could conceal like 75% more, Mike, and we would still be happy. We're just throwing that out there to you in case you can hear us. Why do you people kill my fun?
So that's what's in store, and hopefully
frequently
that won't
with antibiotics.
And hopefully it won't scare you away from tuning in. So catch that next week. We'll be doing a look at the classes.
Oh, yeah, that'll totally happen. So,
all right, now that we got that out of the way, I think that... do we have anything from our last episode? Let's see. Oh, yeah, we got a hold of Don Samora. He gave us a nice email back. So we're going to be featuring Don Samora up here shortly. Haven't really got anything certain, but I think we're... thinking about it, Don, if you're listening, you claim that you listen to this podcast. We're sorry. We're sorry.
Yeah, we apologize in advance.
Yeah. But we think about maybe doing an interview just off the top of our heads. Anything I don't think we combat. We can kick around a topic if you want, but yeah, we'll get a hold of you and let you know about that. If you're not familiar with Wizard Tower Games, it's fine folks here in Battle Creek doing some great productions and
yeah, man, we'll scheme
they're doing
a little
the
scheme.
Lost modules of Gary Khan from Tim Cass. That's a project he's working hard on, as well as D20 Dungeon, though. And
there's
some other. There's another module. Jeez, what's the other one? Why don't you look that up? We're gonna plug him.
Yeah, if we're gonna plug him, we're gonna plug him right because, like, he definitely deserves it. Wizard Tower is games. Class act. Does stuff that we personally look at and go, oh, God, right in the feels. Mostly because those of us who remember both the 1E and the Red Box and Blue Box eras, there's just like a time and a place to it that is very hard to recapture. It takes a precise art to do it. And the folks at, Dungeon Essentials. I'm sorry, what was it? Old School Essentials, OSE.
Old School Essentials, Necrotic Gnome Games.
And a few others, they've captured it. They've really found that place, that sweet spot that represents that. And Wizard Tower is another one that joins that vaunted clique of
But it's
people.
D20 delving, just want to interrupt for a quick second here. It's
yeah.
D20 delving, so I'm getting confused with something less infamous, so forgive us, Don. D20 delving, great game that's going to be text to voice, so that's been exciting.
Ooh.
We'll talk about that, as well as some of the modules. Looks like they got some Game Master Guide here for open worlds role-playing game, official. So yeah, they got some RPG stuff. Adventure games. I was looking for, maybe it's not up yet. Check out Wizard Tower Games for yourself. I'm just fumbling through here. You get distracted. Oh, but yeah, the Lost Modules of Gary Tom. That is very much old school. So, yeah, but check them out. You'd be glad you did if you know, like old school gaming with in the modern era. So, anyway, but yeah, we're here talking about the Monsters Arms Race. So, I think we've pretty much done everything we can to distract ourselves from getting into the topic. So it's time to head on.
All right, let's dive in and start the meat and potatoes on this.
Yeah, so the Monsters Arms Race, what are we really talking about here? So, from the early editions of the game, when the days were young, and not all the monster lists were well known, a lot of players...
They hadn't even invented all the hours in the day yet. There were only like 16 hours. Even the days were very short. You didn't notice because when you'd go to sleep, there were just a couple hours shaved off here, and while you were right, a couple hours shaved off there at the beginning and right at the end. Yeah, you almost didn't notice it. And then they finally invented all those extra hours. Yeah. That's why we're so tired.
Right. In the early days, you didn't have a huge list of monsters. They were pretty quick to learn pretty much the DM described them, as well as what... they've read some of the instruction manuals to begin with, like the Monsters book and the White Box set. They already knew those or had skimmed through it. They had a good understanding of what they were going to be running up against. So it was pretty easy for some guys just to run right in and announce October, Wednesday the 17th, and the monster would fall over dead. Right? Now, how did you know that? Oh, well, you know, just my care. Put on the back of the character sheet, my character's trained in Arcane Lore. He knows the specific words to counter certain of these monsters and curses. So, yeah, he's a fortune teller's son. So, you said you wanted me to roleplay more. Uh-huh. And, so dealing with scoundrels like that, DMs got pretty wise to their disguise.
And let's also, take just a brief moment to mention the origins of the problem is that, Frankly, the people who initiated gaming were war gamers. They were heavily calculation oriented. They were very detail specific, mm-hmm. as is required. There was a very specific structure to what could be done and what could not be done. And at the onset of role playing games, they began to peel away a little of the structure. So that there was just a little more looseness in terms of what could you do. And this opened a Wild West zone, especially amongst some of the up-and-coming, newly arriving players who were mostly culled out of universities, and in many cases were every bit the pocket protector-wearing engineering student that you might imagine. I mean, just... if you can imagine people who are extremely detail-oriented and formulaic in their approach, power gaming, that is what happened. So yes, they would memorize manuals and they knew every monster by heart. And if, you know, I know that silver kills this. So if I see any sign of that, like, and even before we go into the dungeon, like, I have a silver-tipped spear and a silver-tipped dagger on my character at all times. I have
10 silver-tipped arrows and a silver-tipped dagger.
And I'm also wearing a necklace made out of garlic cloves at all times. Yes, I may smell like an Italian restaurant, but I don't care.
All right.
At which point the DM learns to say, okay, you are literally not of interest to vampires. They stay away from you. However, as it happens, all the other creatures in the dungeon consider you twice as delicious now.
You know, there is a drawback to wearing garlic. Some monsters actually...
Look, this one spiced itself.
I'm going to throw you in the pot. You already come pretty spiced. Hey,
so hey, could we spread a rumor that onions keep away owlbears? And if he's wearing both, he would make good soup.
So, yeah, I mean, yeah, they were very detail-oriented character players, as well as dungeon masters, who wanted to know the exact range of cannons and would memorize the rules for the longitudinal axis of a cannon. In Napoleonics, you would need to know.
Yeah.
Like, at 36 inches, that's the extended range, so keep your cavalry exactly 36 inches from the cannon at all times. Keep your cavalry 36 inches from the cannon at all times. Apply directly to the cavalry.
Yes.
Cannon. Napoleonics. So, yeah, they memorize that, but I want to take a moment here, because when we talk about a lot of these people, we're just talking about role-playing games, and I found an interesting tidbit about... one of the guys who first used the term role-playing outside of the gaming sphere was, or put it into the gaming sphere, I should say, is J. Eric Holmes, the guy who did the Blue Box set.
Oh.
Basically came up and said, you know, your rules are kind of hard to understand. I'm a professor of neurology. I have a degree in University of Southern California in education as well. So I would
and
like
this text makes my brain hurt.
Yep. So he was also a first lieutenant in the Marine Corps and fought for 2 years in Korea,
which directly challenges my narrative that it was his brain that hurt.
But anyway, yeah. So,
I'm just messing with
he's just J. Edgar Rice. He was a big fan of J. Edgar Rice Burroughs. Also did some pastiches of those, as well as some stuff of H.P. Lovecraft. But anyway, he wrote that, and it was him that was accredited for using the term role-playing outside of, you know, a way to deal with therapeutic blocks or conditional situations that you couldn't quite get across.
Yeah, you had to get other people to step outside of their own shoes, right. Like to lay aside the ego of the self and say, yes, that's what you would do, but what if, for instance... Yeah. You had a different background and you were in a different situation and you were wearing the other person's shoes. After a lifetime, 20 years of being a cobbler, how do you feel about the shoe business now?
Sure. And so Jerry Holmes was the one credited with bringing role-playing game terms to full bear for role-playing, you know, a role-playing game, because it was the white box that basically... It was fantasy adventure or gaming, and he changed it to more role-playing. But that's a side topic we want to bring to it, as a sidebar to start prepping us for the other part.
I remember the game started off with a company name that started with tactics and strategy.
Yeah, so, tactical study rules.
Yeah, tactical studies rules. It just literally implied things that most people, like, that sounds very mathy. And... I'm not entirely sure I'm open to that. Okay, I hear you, but have you ever, you know, slaughtered monsters in their lair in the tradition of the epics of Beowulf?
The Campbellian. I don't know if that's a real word. I just made it up.
Or would you like to...
The journey of the hero, yeah. But
the Arthurian mythos, you know, would you like to recreate that? Like, here's a team of knights. And, like, these ones will not be clapping coconuts together.
Yeah. Okay, but
yeah,
on to the topic.
It had appeals,
but there, he was around and brung it in there. But one of the things that they mentioned was that the variety of monsters was still pretty much static. It was what they tried bringing some new monsters in, and you can definitely see that on the Greyhawk, not the Greyhawk role-playing game supplement for the Fantasy World setting, but the Greyhawk booklet supplement for the original White Box set. And you see the Beholder on in there, and that's when we first were like, yeah, man, you know, you see this great big eye, it's on, surrounded by other eyes, it's just got one big old mouth, and yep. Thank you, Seth Skorzkowski, because I'm going to be using that for the rest of my life to describe how it was back in the days when somebody described a Beholder for the first time. But yeah, you got weird monsters like that. And so that's what the craziness of the time was, is that you were trying to outdo yourself to have monsters that players were not familiar with so they would be surprised. Because the first time you fight orcs is kind of exciting. You know, they're orcs. What are they doing? They're glowing red eyes and lolling tongues and their dark skin with these tusks and horrible pig faces, and they're trying to kill you. But after you butchered your 851st orc, starts to lose a little bit of its allure. You spice it up again, you know, I want to get back to those old days, which that's a whole different expectation.
There comes a time when gold loses its luster and all that is left. It's a father's love for his child.
Or need to have a good monster to beat up. So, and that's where this started. So, primarily, as we're starting to creep up to the 30-minute mark here.
Before we launch on the real rising Cold War, we'll take our break.
Yeah, we're going ahead and take a break. So, hopefully you stick around. We haven't scared you off too much. So, enjoy the break. We'll be right back. All right, and we're back. So, we ate up first half hour BSing and avoiding the topic.
But, we're here. We launched into the opening intros.
It was the 80s. It was during the Reagan administration. So we had the Cold War era fully upon us. And players were getting pretty wise to the kind of monsters that were coming out, especially with release in about 77, 78 of the Monster Manual.
Correct. This brings us... it fast forwards us to the era in which the largest number of people were beginning to become familiar with the game. And a pretty solid variety of monsters was available at that time. This was a huge expansion, considering where the game had begun in its infancy in the White Box sets
booklets,
the additional booklets. They had added a lot of material. And they kept statting out new opportunities and new challenges, many of which were invented by actual players, brought up at little mini cons of the earliest era.
Dragon magazine writers.
Which was well before our time, because we were just little badgers.
You were just youngins and greenhorns getting into the game.
By the time 78 and 79 were over, and much of the early true first edition stuff had received its print runs, it was hitting our generation. We were stumbling into it. And unlike the rarefied few who were DMs at a few universities scattered across the U.S., and in particularly heavily in the Midwest, you began to see a enormous increase in the number of people trying to Dungeon Master. And an enormous increase in the number of players. Now, every time you widen this and create more agency, the like Ouroboros, the snake eats its tail. You meet your own problem. As more people play, more imagination and more creativity comes into the game, and more monsters find
more
themselves
things
being nerfed.
Right, the mystery is gone.
Yeah.
For a lot of players. I mean, there were so many people that had a copy of the Monster Manual, even though they never DM'd. No, why did you have a copy of the Monster Manual? Well, I might DM sometime. That was the standard excuse. Well, yeah, but you've read through it. So you're pretty familiar with what the basic ecosystem is in a dungeon or the monsters that you encounter, like trolls, hate fire, and a lot of other things.
hide your favorite weapon from the rust monster.
Right. A few other things were pretty self-evident from mythology, like werewolves.
Iron spikes used to be carried by adventurers for proper purposes, like jamming doors shut so that reinforcements cannot come charging through it quickly. But they also became, oh, I keep these in case of a rust monster so that I can hurl a satchel full of iron spikes and then run away.
And I cover them with geritol. So, you got a plethora of monsters out of there. Plethora, yes. You got a plethora of monsters out of there.
How many are in a plethora?
In this case, 8. There were very specific monsters, too, that you begin to look at and like, what in the heck? And so we'll start with the obvious one. Somewhere, somehow, a DM got cheesed off that his players were taking all this time with chests. You know, just like, okay, you know, they're paranoid that there's going to be a poison lock. It could be a trap. It could be, you know, a latch that drops a vial of poison gas into the whole thing, you know, anything can happen, right? Right?
Yeah, well,
the last thing they're waiting for is it for the chest to attack them. And that's exactly what the mimic was. So the minute they touched the chest, it had an adhesive coating to it. And you were stuck. And then it would bludgeon you to death and then just kind of ooze over you. Now, the more familiar mimic that we see in popular culture is the killer mimic, which develops fangs and actually has an intelligence and could be talked to by elite players.
Could be reasoned with under ideal circumstances.
You could throw out the body of the halfling torchbearer who died in the rooms.
Nobbyfoot!
Go get Nobbyfoot. Throw him. he seems to be pretty malfunctioned.
Oh, man.
And
he paid his dues to the henchman's guild.
Yeah, so once they got wise to the mimic, then it became the killer mimic. And now there's, and then, you know, the mimic starts to branch off from just chests or innocent barrels or innocent looking furniture to chairs and tables and bookcases because those also attract adventurers.
Much more complicated pieces of furniture.
So now the players are distrusting even the furniture. But wait, that's not all.
That lampshade is looking pretty shifty.
Yeah. I think it laughed at me. Then the ceiling dropped in on you. Oh, but it wasn't just rocks falling. No, this one drops on you and even can propel itself on the ground, fluttering around on jets of gas. The lurker above showed up. And, you know, okay, so yeah, it would drop on you, smother you, and crush you to death. But, oh, we're still not done with you yet. Because of the trapper, the floor itself. So, literally, that's where you started seeing, like, okay, I hear you DMs. You are very frustrated with players goofing around, trying to get around all your well-laid traps. And so, in order to close the game and commit a TPK, you had a trapper or a lurker above show up. And then, you know, and then at that point, okay, so all the dungeon decor could serve as a possible hostile. And even the walls and ceiling themselves can attack us from
like
time to time.
Wet greenish moss is dripping from like the stalactite above. It's not moss. That's green slime.
Or, yeah, and then we see the piercers. And then ropers. You know, the piercers who appear to be some kind of mollusk that its life cycle is it waits until something warm-blooded drops beneath it or comes between it, and then it drops and pales it, climbs out, and then devours the dead body. Okay.
And it's go time. Then it's all energized and goes and makes baby piercers.
Yep.
Now, these weird creatures that are landscape and terrain-based became a very popular theme, and they emerged for every possible environment you can imagine, from like ice and sand, you know, mountainsides.
Yeah, there was a specific water. Trapper in Monster Manual 2.
Just plain water is intruded upon by the water weird.
Yep. Oh. There was a trapper that was in sand that could move around pretty fast and chase you down. It was just... Okay, so yeah.
They had the sandlings.
So this world is a cruel, hateful world.
Oh, yeah.
And where everything all the time is bending its will to destroy you.
Well, one of the arts of the DM is to thoughtfully apply when and where to place a challenge, a thing that we have brought up in the past a number of times on other, you know, related or similar topics, is that, like, this is the art form. This is not the science of it, because it's not a science. You know, there's no perfect formula. It's an extension of playing partly to your audience, shuffling your material routinely so that you don't riff on the same note. And this was a tough one for a lot of very early first-time DMs to do. You know, like, how do you know when not to, you know, like, it's six trappers in a row. I feel like you're trying to tell us something, that, like, the floor is this like a giant game of the floor is lava?
Because it just might be.
Yeah, because this is wearing thin real quick. Or you can only hit people with the illusionary floor that they fall through just so many times before the riff is ruined. And hey, look, I'm not dissing anybody, because we made exactly these mistakes.
And also, you're talking DM about tells.
Yeah, when like you're adolescents, you know, adolescents will riff on something they find hilarious until it is no longer funny at all.
Yeah, they definitely run it in the ground. But there's also, for your older players, there was the poker.
I have no excuse for my conduct, because I still do that. I'm kidding.
It's true.
It's partly true. I do that with jokes. I don't do that with monsters anymore.
Right before TPK, I always get a sadistic smile on my face. I'm just like, yep, here's another one to add to the screen. Another skull and crossbones to put on the side of the fuselage. But at the same time, your goal as a DM is not to kill the players. But this is what we're talking about, the arms race. Now,
yeah, this is where Dirty Pool came out.
Now, everybody had a copy of the Monster Manual, and they were pretty much wise to the wily wiles of the DM. They were starting to get familiar. Yeah, you know, all the architecture could potentially be a monster. Could be a door.
Yeah, we're now using 10-foot poles. This is why the 10-foot pole. What's that for? Why would anybody even carry one of these around? It's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of.
It is kind
of
dumb, but
y'all weren't there.
You know, the sacks of flour, all the silly stuff, the bag of marbles. I mean, yeah, it was all there for a reason. But it had its uses. It was just silly.
If you didn't have, like, detect invisible lurking in your spell list back in those days, you threw a bag of flour. and you knew what was coming or going in or out of that room.
You might have enough. You might have enough wherewithal to guess that where it is at that particular moment. But in the long and short terms, these were things that were already, you could deal with those. Those were fantasy concepts. The fact that the monsters could be just the dungeon decor themselves was highly disturbing for a lot of players. And so, like Mike said, it got war then pretty quick. So as players began to get kind of wise, like, oh, it's a cavern with a lot of stalactites, huh? Okay, well, I'm going to walk around the corners very carefully.
Yeah, the weaknesses.
Oh, and then you bump into, okay, you're passing a stalagmite, and suddenly a great eye opens up and a large fanged mouth. Crap. Yeah, it's one of those. Yeah, it's a roper.
Versus mouse, spy versus spy.
The DM had all the advantages. And so if you wondered why players were paranoid, but we're going to discuss the other part of the arms race. This is the one that really had the unrestrained proliferation of crazy monsters, was the Bean Folio. And it hasn't...
Yeah, the Monster Manual 2 did a fair job, I think.
Yeah, but that was a little later.
It had a lot of, you know, merits to it, and a lot of expanded material based on existing material.
Well, we'll be moving
but
to that one in a bit.
But the
Bean
Folio is the most... in many ways, it's even more true early D&D.
Because it covered those early years in White Dwarf.
Yeah.
In the late 70s and very early.
A lot of those monsters had never made it into major publication before in the United States. And man, it was like, okay, look under your chairs. You get a nuke. You get a nuke.
Well,
you
no.
get a nuke. We got nukes for everybody. And the button got pushed at every table. What do you mean a gold bug just ate my brain?
And then there's also the infamous character, like the hook horror, the growl.
Oh, the growl.
You know, giant floating brain with tentacles and a beak and obviously a homicidal streak a mile wide. I just hate everything. Yeah, okay. Yeah, who knew these things were there, along with Sons of Chaos and Coffer Corpses. I mean, and let's not forget the Revenant, and I have a hard time pronouncing this one, as I do with most of the English language, but since this is English, the Penanggalan.
Oh, Penanggalan, yeah.
Yeah, that, oh my gosh, yeah, that was just a straight-up gore fest.
Freakish.
Yeah, and so, not only did you have that on top of that, you also had some kind of sneaky monsters, like the Sheet Ghoul. That was literally a sheet that was some form of undead that would cover you, and then it would create the servants around it. No one knew why. It was just a thing. That's the whole thing. And along with things that you would normally expect, like keratin columns, you know. Yeah, okay, like so
a post battle with the sheets, you know, it's
I burn them. Yep.
No, I'm sorry. It looks like somebody spilled a bag of laundry.
So, you got things like the keratin columns, which you would pretty
that
much
means
expect.
We won.
So yeah, we would
keratin columns, the more normal sized statues that
we're not dealing with stone golems, but yeah, they were pretty bad. And, you would find out, oh, I just strike. It must be just like another form of monster made out of stone that I can kill, apparently, with a sword. And then my sword snaps. And then you're like, but that was a +3 sword. Well, maybe you shouldn't have just swung it at a character column. What do you expect was going to happen? Well, I strike a stone golem. Doesn't seem like that's ever happened before. Well, there you go. Yeah, they kind of one of the things of early D&D. But we digress. We just get right on to the point that that Fiend Folio opened up, like, you didn't know it was going to happen now, because not everybody had access to it, and it was one of the more overlooked and very sinister. Like, if you saw that in somebody's shit bookshelf, and they were DMing, you knew, like, okay,
I better bring my A game, because this is going to get weird. Nilbogs, you know.
Reverse goblins, when you hit them, they get their hit points back. So it's one that has 400 hit points. He's wandering the dungeon.
Yeah.
Okay.
Uber Gub.
Until they figured out that, like, well, wait, they have a maximum hit point potential of double. Oh, okay. That's better. Phew. Had me worried.
Yeah, I got to say, one thing I did not appreciate or respect in players particularly was... like, there is a trait. Like, I'm not saying that DMs don't power trip, because they do. It's a problem for DMs. That's a DM problem. Mm-hmm. Where they're power tripping, and it's just about, like, as much torture as possible, as much torment and mayhem as possible, before ultimately subjecting the players to failure. That's not great DMing. You know, that's, like, if you're purely gratifying yourself at the other people's expense, you're not fostering their enjoyment. Unless they're really into that. I'm just throwing it out there. They better be super enthusiastic about that if that's how you're going to roll. But, you know, the player that cannot bear to be foiled by anything, that cannot bear that dice sometimes decide things, and they need to take that back away from the dice and put it back in their lap. Like, that if I insulate myself with a sufficient amount of knowledge and I know what all the monsters are, if I have calculated all the risks, then there is no way I can fail. You're wrong. That is not the point. There are times where you'll be challenged and your character may not be able to meet that challenge at this time. You know, failure is not the end. It is a different beginning. It is you trying another way. You know, you got to think laterally, not like
that. That sounds like quitting talk.
Yeah, There's more than one way to skin a cat, said the homespun ranger. And I happen to know for a fact that that is completely accurate.
Well, we won't delve into that any further. But try to move.
I'm sorry, borrowing from the mayor on third season Buffy.
But getting back to the point that the Fiend Folio opened up a whole can of worms about crazy monsters that
multiple hit dice worms.
And you got a lot of players paranoid again, and that was kind of a good thing because they were on their toes. You seen that on somebody's show, you knew that you might be in for a wild ride. The other part of this, Lance, is that, as we were talking about the Monster Manual 2, there were various modules and other supplements that come in. And we're back. Oops, it just had another little hiccup there. So, all right. Yeah, but we were talking about the Monster Manual 2, but it came out. But we're also talking about a lot of the modules during that time had started to feature bonus monsters, as well as Dragon Magazine had introduced some new monsters.
It was rapidly becoming a tradition. It had gone from being an understood portion of the game that might or might not happen to almost being one of the selling points of a new module. Like, there are 8 new monsters, or there is a whole separate booklet in the Lost Caverns of Sekanth for all of the huge array of monsters. It just, Monster Mania has come to town.
Right, and you know what? This was a creative time, and I think this is what a lot of people talk about when they say this is the best time for TSR. Everybody has a different era for the Golden Age. I'm not going to discuss that too much here.
We're not going to beat up anybody else's golden age. Right. Golden age is when you felt that like crest, that manic wave, when you just really rode that pipeline surf into the horizon. At that moment, just feeling amazing. Good for you. Nobody here is going to try and take that away from you. So, like, everybody's got a golden age, but this was one for us. We experienced it at the same time, and I gotta say, it was kind of great. Because even if we were tangling, because we were both DMs and we were both players, even if we were tangling back and forth like cats and dogs, it was this constant process of discovery.
Right. It was. Look, sitting on either side of the screen, we could both be our best friends as well as our own worst enemies. Some of our best debates have been on opposite sides of the screen.
Yeah.
And so that said, you can only have that kind of environment if you actually have deep respect for the other person. Because you wouldn't want to convince, if it was just some schmo, you just walk away from the game. You just like some schmuck. Yeah, well, who cares? Screw you. You know, give him the finger and off you go. But if it's somebody who you're deeply committed to in a respectful relationship, you just can't discard that willy-nilly. But getting back onto the topic of monsters, man, we just want to stray all over the place today. So I'm taking a wheel. We're getting back onto the Monster Manual 2, which you were covering well. So I'm going to let you pick it up right there. Came up with a lot of good stuff.
Well, yeah, and this is where we saw, like, the third and final evolution there. I believe it was in the second edition, before they compiled everything into the binder version.
Yeah, the Monstrous Compendiums.
The Monstrous Compendiums. The third significant book of monsters was the Monster Manual 2, and it included some radical alterations to the vegetable landscape, adding a lot of outdoor threats. Now, it's not that these did not exist, like subterranean and outdoor threats did exist in the other books, but the Monster Manual 2 seemed to really wise up to the fact that you need enough variety.
Like the pitcher plants.
Giant sundew.
The weird Bascomoid that was actually ambulatory and chased you down.
Yeah, rolling spore ball. You know,
there was also, and this was a derivative of the Shrieker and then the Violet Fungi. Which, hey, he was a fun guy, until you walk,
it's not that fun of a guy.
Nope.
Turns out not so much.
Yeah, Shrieker's nuisance monster, but, potentially lethal. You need to deal with them in some effective way. Yeah. Most of the time, it's players hitting it until it's dead. It's Clement Clyde's.
But hangman trees and wolf and sheep's clothing and...
Oh, yeah.
Wolf
and sheep's clothing. It's a stump with a little cute rabbit on there. And I love the Pathfinder First Edition Unusual Monsters Revisited, where they got both Sione and Marissa like, oh, look at the cute bunny. And then you see the eye stalks coming up behind them. And then the mouth is starting to open on the other side of the stump. Because that's what it does. It comes up, wraps you up with the eye stalks, and then shoves you into its very tooth maw, and it becomes a very violent and extreme encounter very quickly. So, yeah, who thought up the wolf's and sheep clothing? Well, you know, obviously people like cute fuzzy, right? So here we go. And then we had the weird ones like the squealer, and then we ended up with the end game, the frog hemoth.
Oh, well... You know, not necessarily even end game, but I mean, yeah, in terms of insane aberration. Yeah. Oh man. But it only got weirder and weirder. I liked what they did to oozes because, and puddings and, mm-hmm. you know, that ilk, because it was settled into a routine. I mean, you had your yellow mold and your green slime and, you know, but.
And then brown mold.
Gray ooze. But they began to flex a little with things that could hide their nature, not be easily recognized.
Crystal ooze and water.
Yeah. You know, as a
brightly visible,
nearly amoeboid lake creature that just, you know, is insanely hard to spot. Until it's too late.
Yeah, until you're taking damage.
Now, then you get to fight back. Or things like the giant antlion.
Yeah, basically, once again, I'm watching the Nature Channel. And
dust diggers.
They came out with also a whole bunch of quasi-elementals, para-elementals. And they continued on that with Dragon Magazine and the Manual of the Planes for a little bit.
Then they branched off a large variety of demons and devils that...
Yeah, next they're planar beasties like the Modrons.
And, yeah. They populated the other realms in a way that I think was desperately called for. So I don't want, in our discussion, as we characterize this as a war between the DM and the player that expanded outwards, driving monster creativity... and then, of course, player response to that creativity. And as soon as the players have developed mastery, the DM then has to go through the process all over again, ultimately leading to the homebrew concept. No, we're not really poo-pooing that. I just wanted to take that minute out and say we're not upset that that is the way things were, and even now is still the way things are. There's a hunger to, well, if I just know everything, I can't lose. Let go of that, man. Let go. Like a, to borrow from Fight Club, you know, find your power animal. Slide. You know, just let go. And enjoy the roller coaster ride. It is a wonderful thing. And it's also... You know, to the DMs who are frustrated by it, it's an essential part of the game. It comes with the turf. There's only just so upset you can be by it. And honestly, this would not be the game that it is. This would not be the evolving fun that is still valid if it had been so fixed and so rigid. We wouldn't be enjoying it now. I think it would have gone by the wayside, grown stagnant and dull, and have been forgotten. Like there would just be a few thousand little white boxes floating around the country somewhere, and that would have been in the entire history of D&D. But because it was an evolving game that encouraged player and DM involvement, like for you to be the creative, you're going to have to fill in the blanks, you're going to have to do some of this yourself. Because of that, and I believe only because of that, if it weren't for that, this game would not have prospered the way it did. And because of it, it has become this enormous thing we see today.
Yeah, I definitely agree with almost the entirety of that. I'm going to do the proverbial, but
okay.
I think other games too had a hand in increasing the power curve, as it was, or the arms race, adding their own twist to it. Ardour and Gormoire.
Oh, yeah.
Spent a lot of time upgrading some crazy monsters that you just would not want to encounter in any way, shape, or form. What do these things do when they're not murdering adventurers? Just hanging out.
Like they don't really have any other food source. Well, there's a lot of you adventurers.
Yeah, you know, you guys keep coming here, so.
It only needs to eat one of you for like a month, maybe 2 months, you know.
Could live without. What do these things do? And then there, obviously, every game creates its own new monsters. RuneQuest had the Woctopus and the Jack-O-Bear. Which, okay, hey, there you go. But that's imagination. You don't know what it does. What the heck is this thing? It's a fuzzy jack-o'-lantern-headed beast. Okay, with claws. And apparently the ability to beguile you. Right. So, I'm going to see you next week, Steve. Bye. Some people talk about that one as being an immersion breaker, which I'm kind of like, well, you know, welcome to the West Coast, man, in the 70s. There was a lot of that going around. But you had that. You also had, D&D just coming out with a Monster of the Week flavor, and, you know, they fully leaned into it. They didn't even quit. And what we're trying to get to it is that at Monster Manual 2, it seemed like we had reached with stuff like the Frog Hemoth and some of the Squealer and some of the more bizarre monsters. It seemed like people had pretty much had their fill of that. And then we talk about second edition. Monsters kind of became codified. There were strategic talks about arms limitations among monsters. And so we started to kind of have rational discussions about what were limits. And
I want to say that in like each first edition of the game, most of the outrageousness did not appear at the very onset.
No.
Like they would strip back down to the basics and release the more sensible, familiar stuff first. And then the more complicated, weird stuff
people
later.
People called the race Nazgul.
Oh, yeah, in the white box editions.
Yeah, they called the race Nazgul. So you were more or less, you kind of were in familiar territory. Like, it's a Black Rider, right? Yeah, cool, I'm going to kill a Black Rider. Well, that's what you think.
Yeah, you think. Yeah, your plan at this time is to kill a Black Rider. Let's see how that works out for you.
Well, what do you mean he doesn't take any damage from my weapon? He just doesn't take any damage from weapon. You know what I mean? He just passes right through him. He's more spirit than he is substance. And he's still hitting me. Yeah, and you're losing levels. This game sucks.
Now, are you wielding a really powerful magic sword?
Oh, I didn't have a magic weapon. Oh, well, then you're kind of screwed.
That would be one of your problems.
You need to start running. So now you start to understand Frodo and Sam's dilemma, leaving the Shire and Pippin. Yeah, being pursued by these things was completely beyond their ability to cope with. Now, we're just going to push that out of the way and just say that there were other monsters besides just tokens in those games. They did lean heavily to a few others. And, hey, the Temple of the Frog, giant carnivorous frogs. Okay, I guess. I mean, we've got everything else. Why not?
Yeah.
Who cares? Giant spiders? Right, we got those too. You know, are giant spiders just all tokens? Well, the talking ones are. But precisely, who would want to talk to one of those things? They're kind of crazy. You get into some esoterics on in a little bit of that white box, like bugbears and a few others. You're like, what are you talking about? Bugbears just like a mental handicap that you have about a phobia that just haunts you in a recurring memory or intrusive thought pattern. That's what that's supposed to be from the Freudian terms, but they statted it out. It's three, apparently, mental.
Three
intrusive thoughts are, has a 3+1 hit dice, so who knew? But, yeah, that's what they were doing. They were using terms like hobgoblins. Like the hobgoblin is just your mental foe that you conjure up to fight against. But apparently it's +1 hit dice and lawful evil and hates orcs as well as elves.
Yeah, contempt for everything and everyone. Crazy, arrogant, and highly organized.
Or Uruk-hai, if you really want to break it down. But they weren't using,
they tried not to be too
actually after that cease and desist,
yeah,
that was not too
could you
funny.
Please stop using these words. Because,
but we got into a lot of monsters by experiencing other books too. You would read a book, and maybe there was a unique monster that the author conjured up, and you'd see a lot of those. I'm trying to think of a specific one, but I think the Thomas Covenant series had a couple that I noticed. Later when I was it's a difficult read for me, folks, so you know, don't think too lowly of me about it, because I could never get past the first one for a number of years, and then finally I was like, oh, that's where that monster comes from. Oh, okay. Yeah, before there were the Dementors. Anyway, we talk about a lot of adjacent things, and good artists should always borrow. Oh. But also, they should great artists to you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, don't be afraid to
in the art of DMing.
That was a big one we saw. It was you read a book or maybe a comic, and you got an idea for something, and then you statted it up on a piece of lined notebook paper, pencil, and that was your monster. And that was as much effort as it took. It was more imaginative than it was a process of actual creation. But
and because we were very young, there were a lot of shortfalls, a lot of gaps where like homebrew monster creation went horribly awry.
It
was not level appropriate. The challenge rating system did not exist at that time, which is why, despite being an old school player, like never minding my love for the first edition and for the old, you know, box sets, that's not important. I acknowledge without reservation that in terms of giving players the tools to become dungeon masters, the challenge rating system was a step in the right direction. It was a great choice, and it has helped lot of players avoid some of the worst of, and I mean,
it's not
believe
perfect.
Me, we made monumental errors of judgment, which is why last week, you know, somebody brought up my longstanding shame. The Bone Snapper incident, where like junior DM, you know, like Mr. Enthusiastic thought, well, look at him. They've only got like 12 or 13 hit points each. There's no way he's going to mow through these things in a cool minute. And I was not paying attention to the three attacks around each, with the bite attack being 2d8 damage.
Well, yeah, Randy's a jerk. He's armed in plate mail three, but he's using a two-handed sword, so he'll be. But, you know, when they roll really
He'll be fine.
He'll walk it off. He's a paladin. He'll heal through it. But look, I'm like, jeez, these guys are ripping me apart. You do know, Mike, I only have 18 hit points at certain level, right?
Yeah. Well, they were just pulling him apart, man. Like, they were.
Also, let's put it this way.
It was like a tug of war.
I was not rolling well.
His character was the wishbone out of a turkey, okay? And those bone snappers were just like rolling 15, 16, 17s, 18s. Dice were hot.
They were hungry. And you certainly showed it. So.
They've tasted blood and they want more. More.
But the critical, not critical, the challenge rating system is not perfect. It's evolved. I think first edition, it's pretty good. I think probably even tighter as the Pathfinder second edition one. I mean, the Pathfinder one was a little bit better, but I think fifth edition took some steps in the right direction.
Yeah.
But, you know, everybody said, well, they're not perfect. Well, of course not. No system is.
God forbid that it should become perfect. Because had it been perfect when it started, this game would have died out, like I said. And it is that absence of perfection, that ability for constant change. If it were not for that, we would be lost.
Yeah.
That's why it's an adventure, because it's not perfect. Like a formula would be dull. It's an equation. You just plug in exactly what you're supposed to, and the outcome is always uniform. My God, that would be dull as death. I don't think I would enjoy a single minute of that. I just described algebra class, and I'm sorry for those of you who enjoyed that. I'm not trying to defame your favorite hobby, but trust me, not a great seller. Okay, it's algebra, the movie. Things nobody has ever said.
Well, I was just going to say that I think you encapsulated the closing scene out of Patton when he's writing the designs and talking about war. What about this push-button warfare, General, that they're talking about? A hell of a way to fight a war. I don't want no part of it.
Yeah, that's
how about it's just not fighting wars? That would be cool too. But anyway, hey, this is our post Thanksgiving. I think this is a good place to wrap it up.
Yeah,
we
sure,
wanted
man.
To say we're thankful for all our listeners out there. Not only just your support, but just your listens. You know, the real fact that we have a very high listener engagement. You guys are fantastic. And so,
yeah, we're not the people with the most listeners, but I do like to think that we are one of those people with the best. You know, like we scored the cream of the crop.
We have tens of listeners, but they all listen to us. So that is great. And that is something we're thankful for. So thank you all for listening and putting up with us. So without further ado, I think we're going to close up the shop for the day and pack it in. But before we go,
it's the day after Thanksgiving, and I'm sure you're sick of turkeys.
We're all dried up. So, yeah, we wanted to say that also remember to check us out in that Facebook group where we have the Dice of Screaming. We've been getting some nice feedback, and it's very heartening to see the likes and some of the comments. So that helps us. And
I've been trying to pop in more and participate on a regular basis now. Just like this last couple of weeks, because I have been remiss. Like, I've been through a season of keeping my distance from as much social media as possible. And I'm coming out of, I'm crawling out of the bunker and reacquainting with myself with the, what strange new forms of life are these? My God, the world has changed while I was away. Dude, it's only been about 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And look how much has changed. It's magnificent. Whole mutant tribes have risen in the wasteland. Ooh, I wish.
Yeah, I wish.
He has to talk me down from this cliff like literally every 6 months. I'm not even kidding.
But all right, yeah. So we're going to wrap it up here. So we'll see you next week. So until the next time.
May the dice always roll in your favor. We're out.
See ya.